Today, Inside the Debt Trap. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, World's Latest Post, covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. Today, I'm joined by author of Just Money. Royce, hello, good to see you.
Hello, it's good to see you too.
Great to catch up with you. And this book that I've got hold of is an amazing story all about the debt trap and Australia in particular. And it's what's so interesting about it is it's coming from a couple of perspectives, right? As well as the broader tapestry about what's gone on, it's also your own story and how you sort of bumped into this. So can we start with a little bit of background about that, and then perhaps extend the conversation more broadly to what you found out more, you know, as you investigated?
Sure. And I mean, look, the story starts with a bad day. I mean, the simple version is I had a car accident. I was very close to home. I swore the car wasn't there. I was very wrong. And then what unfolded was a very long 8 months process in terms of negotiating with this company and trying to work out how much of the value of this car, because as it turned out, I didn't have their third party property insurance at the time to cover me. And so in that process, it was a strange time, but you know, there were a number of different episodes. But as part of it, I started, and I'm a journalist, I'm not a finance guy or economist. To me, this is my first interaction with the kind of back end of the financial services sector. But I also knew enough not to just give in immediately. I stood my ground, I did my research. And the more I started to research, the more I started to learn about the crazy level of indebtedness that marks Australian society. You know, and for me, there was a couple of just broad brush statistics. There was, you know, the, depending how you cut them, we're either the second or the fourth most indebted people in the world. As I understand it, again, depending how you cut them, we're now the fifth. And so, you know, I began doing what I do and start ask questions, you know, how did this happen? You know, why did this happen? Who was responsible for these decisions? How do we end up here?
And the thing about the book is that you really pick this apart and actually you turn over all the stones, right? And what you discover is there's a real web, I don't know whether you call it conspiracy, but a web of common thinking, which effectively as at the detriment of ordinary Australians, but supports the financial system and the government and pretty much everybody else.
Well, and that's a really interesting way of thinking about it, because what we're talking about here is an ideology. And, you know, ideologies can be big or small. They can be big ideologies like communism and capitalism. And, you know, and there can be little ideologies like the best way to run an office, you know, the best way to structure a company. And those ideologies structure the way we think about things. So the technical term for this is macroeconomic regimes. Really, really boring, really, really uninteresting, unless you're really into this stuff. But this is something that has been, you know, the more you learn, has been running now for, you know, 60 years and has changed dramatically.
Right. And what I find fascinating too is that, you know, a lot of what you're talking about, younger people in particular, will have been brought up in an environment where this is just the way the world is, right? So yeah, I get debt, I get more debt, I get credit cards. It's just the way that things are, without necessarily stopping back and thinking about, well, hang on a moment, why is it this way and what are the implications?
Yeah, and unless you have specialized training in areas like economics or finance or sociology or political economy, you don't know about this. And so there's a big gap. And so when stuff starts to go wrong, it starts to seem really confusing and frustrating in a sense that, like, I don't understand the way this is, because there is no kind of grasp for the social script or the social programming that has created these institutions. And I think for a lot of people, this gets expressed through that kind of intergenerational wealth gap and that conversation around that. And a lot of young people can't, you know, like, talk about this, and they get frustrated because, you know, they can't explain why their parents or grandparents may have had it better off, and, you know, why their parents and grandparents weren't geniuses, but, you know, made a few mistakes along the way, but seemed to get out all right, but they seem to be, you know, they seem to cop it at every turn.
Right. And do you think it's an education thing? I mean, is that fundamentally where we come to in terms of, you know, if people had a better exposure early to some of the elements that actually are required to think about finance perhaps more effectively. Do you think is it education or is it some other form of indoctrination?
This is a real tension here. So it depends how you conceptualize the problem. If you conceptualize the problem as it's all about the individual, and this goes to some of the implicit understanding and assumptions that make up on economics, the idea that people are rational optimizers that go around optimizing every aspect of their existence, when everything we know about people is that that's not the case. You know, people make mistakes, people have limited information, they have constrained rationality. But if you view it as purely an educational issue, it's the idea that all you have to do is give people more financial literacy, run a few workshops, teach them how to handle their money better, and all go away, it doesn't quite work out. And the example I point to in the book is that, the barefoot investor who to his credit, is apparently a lovely guy and does a lot of real work around financial counseling and helping people, educate people, has sold 1 million books. And this problem remains. So this then starts, you get into the other way of thinking about it, whereas it's structural, where that we've created this environment, we've created this series of social and economic institutions that, the average person has to navigate every day. And with a fundamental knowledge asymmetry, because this gets to the kind of frustrating bit about this, using financial literacy as the measure for fixing this, is that for a lot of people, if you're working a 9-to-5, if you're working long days, hard days, you don't have the time and energy to really learn how to handle your finances like with respect to an accountant. You cannot be perfect. So there is a reason why we have a division of labor, and that's it. So if you want to address this, you need to address it in a structural way.
Right. And I guess what I think you're saying, and let me just sort of unpack it a bit further, is that, you can certainly provide a bit more education than a few tools, but this is fundamentally more structural than that, insofar that the way that society is built today, it's built on the assumption that, frankly, more debt is better. And, the only way you're going to get on is you have a debt to do with your university degree. If you went to university, you have a debt to do with your car. You have a debt to do with buying a house. And, of course, there are many organizations that are very happy to lend. And that is just the way it is. And yet, of course, there are so many risks attached. And if things do start to go wrong, of course, that's when the asymmetry really comes into play, doesn't it?
Yeah. And the fundamental principle is buyer beware. So if you get caught up in one of these traps, that's on you. It's just because, and this is where we get to the kind of historical stuff about debt, where there's a big guilt associated with it. So if you make a mistake, that's on you and you're in trouble and don't come talk to me about it.
And, there's the old neoliberal philosophy, which is basically say, debt's fine. But if you take debt, then you have to pay it back to the very last penny, right? And it's like, you'll pay back until the pipsqueak. There is a fundamental philosophical point here about the way that society has developed to the point where the debt is center of gravity, frankly. And, I've even had people say to me, well, it's nuts. Everybody should have debt because interest rates are so low now that it should just be the way to do things. So do you find that people are resistant to this whole concept of debt being a choice and, debt essentially being a risk and a trap rather than opportunity?
Well, it's really interesting as well, because if you want to even take a step back as well, like that idea that debt is everywhere, debt is universal, debt is just part of the way we do business now, it's been presented as very much a new development, a new idea. But, this has a long 5,000-year history, and, human society has had debt since it first began. Debt led to the creation of finance, fiat currency. Like, this is something that's been around forever. It's been tied up with religion and finance and all this. So what we've actually done with these changes is not create something new through the neoliberal reforms of the 80s. We've actually just resurrected an old world, and particularly an old world that, that inverts the interests of, both creditors and debtors. At the moment, we're living in a world that benefits creditors over debtors. Really, we should have changed that around 2008, but, we didn't, and we still kind of continue on down that road. But in terms of talking to people on the ground and their lived experience of this, people understood all this implicitly. I think that even if they didn't, a lot of the time they didn't have the words or language to understand or describe what they were thinking, feeling, and navigating. But they were able to say, they did know when to call bullshit. They did understand the fundamental power dynamics at play. you know, and even me, like I said, I am not trained in this in any way. For me, part of learning about this was, you know, and part of writing the book was learning about this and being able to express it in, you know, plain English, you know, and to treat it like a plumber treats water pressure, right? Like, I could tell you how your toilet works, but don't ask me to provide the underpinning mathematics. So like, I think that frustration, that inability to articulate the situation for a lot of people is a real source of anger. And I think that we see that anger elsewhere.
Yeah, and I wanted to come on to that because one of the things you do highlight is the, you know, there's a sort of an implicit inequality, an implicit frustration, but you touch on in the book that, you know, people are starting to manifest this now, and therefore maybe there are cracks within the societal structure stemming from the debt trap.
Well, and these have been there for a long time. And I think the phrase that I like to use is that, you know, real life is not lived on an average. You could drive across a city and see the wealth divide in real time, even if it's not necessarily showing up in the statistics right now. You know, if you look closely at some of the events over the last 5 to 10 years, and you start to put the lens over it and look at the way that finances were structured and the debts have been issued and, you know, consumed, you know, you see suddenly stuff that seems disparate, isolated, individual starts to make sense as being actually a coded conversation for this deeper frustration and this divide that people are feeling.
So, Royce, what's really interesting about what you've written here is the evolution of finance over the last 20 to 30 to 40 years, right? And it's very much an issue of it's become a set of products, it's being pushed very hard, it's, you know, all based on marketing. Now, tell you a personal story here. My father was a bank manager, right? And, you know, he actually was a pillar of the community, right? He was, you know, next to the vicar and, you know, the other pillars in the local society. He was seen as somebody who was there to help and advise and almost like a father figure to everybody coming through. And he was absolutely horrified by the change in the finance system that he confronted as he moved up through his career, because it moved from being that advisor, that sagely person who was there to help, to frankly just flogging products. And it seems to me that what you've identified in this book is this issue of shifting from, if you like, you know, providing help and advice to just flogging products all the time.
Absolutely, and that's part of how we've wound up in this situation. And unless people can find other work to do, I mean, we're not going to climb our way out of it.
Right, but if in fact, you know, the finance sector is just banging products out and never mind the consequences, I mean, what's the moral consequence of that?
Well, I mean, the moral consequence for a lot of people is that they wind up in trouble and don't even know about it. And they wind up increasingly angry, increasingly frustrated, increasingly confused as time goes on. And ultimately, they're going to be left holding the bag. I mean, we know that as a part of, you know, government policy, that households are being left to pick up the bill at the end. Because ultimately, the question, I guess the moral question is, who has to pay at the end? Will the bank pay, or will they rely on the fact that they'll be bailed out? And will all the risk and the cost be moved onto the average person? I'll leave you to decide which way that will fall.
Well, past history shows us that the banks get bailed out very regularly, but it's at the cost of taxpayers and individuals. And unfortunately, I suspect that things won't change anytime soon. But, you know, well done for calling that out. And it seems to me that that's the fundamental philosophical point, that we've got to think differently about the way our finance system works, because essentially it's too unequal at the moment.
And I think that's a good point. We can fix it if we want to.
So, you know, as we sort of come to the end of this conversation, what would you, as a result of going through this process and writing the book, what would you say to your younger self? What advice would you give that younger self?
Well, it's hard because, I mean, at the outset of writing the book, I did not set out to write an elaborate advert for the insurance industry. You know, for me, there was a much deeper story here. Mm. But obviously, you know, fork out for the car insurance, yes, it sucks. But you know, but even in saying that to my younger self, that's not always possible, right? Because this goes back to what you were saying before in terms of the trade-off of risks. And I've tried to make this point elsewhere, where it's very easy for people who are not in the situation to say, well, you should just have insurance. Mm. But you know, when if you ever find yourself in a situation where you must choose between, say, and I, you know, I've met people like this in the course of research, people who have to choose because they don't have much money, so they can either put petrol on the car to get to work to get the money, or they can pay their registration fees and risk a run-in with the police and have a bigger fine down the track and possibly a court appearance. You know, so at that point of balancing risk and that trade-off, you know, it's really easy for someone not in that situation to tell someone else what to do, but that's not very helpful in the long run.
Right. And it is often trade-offs, and it's often, you know, you make decisions based on the information that you have at the point in time, and it's, you know, easy to go back in time and think, I wish I'd done it differently. But, you know, I have to say, I think that this book, and I'm going to hold it up because I think I recommend it, everybody should read this. And particularly, I think those people who are battling with, do I get a mortgage? Do I not get a mortgage? You know, it's important to understand what is underpinning the debt machine and the implications as you get involved in it, and some of the risks and some of the, you know, factors that are implicit in the way the system works. And I have to say, I think you've done a brilliant job of drawing this out and painting a picture. And I certainly, this will be on my top 10 recommended books for people who want to know more about finance. So great job. Well done. And thanks very much for sharing your thoughts today and sharing your thoughts in the book.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
Terrific. Thank you.